You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, Honorable Justices, may it please the court. My name is Brandon Osterbund, and I represent Deborah Balla. In this case, the trial court effectively nullified the remedial purpose of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act by erroneously instructing the jury that the burden of proof was clear and convincing evidence as opposed to a preponderance standard. Ms. Balla asked that this court should apply the preponderance standard in all VCPA cases across Virginia for two reasons. First, the only standard that is consistent with the remedial purpose of the VCPA is the preponderance standard.
You know, can I interrupt you there? Fraud law, common law fraud law, is a remedy. It provides money damages. It provides equitable remedies, too. Obviously, it's a remedial remedy. And the point of it is to remedy frauds. So there's no remedial fraud and non-remedial fraud. The cause of action is intrinsically a remedial thing. So I don't see how that semantic point affects anything. Because obviously, at least as currently interpreted, common law fraud is not given the preponderance, given the clear and convincing standard.
Well, clearly the General Assembly viewed common law fraud different from a violation of the VCPA. The General Assembly in this particular case saw fit to enact 59.1197, which states that this chapter shall be construed as remedial legislation to promote the fair and ethical standards of dealings between consumers and the suppliers. The purpose of that is essentially to put consumers and suppliers on equal footing. And I suggest to the court that the use of common law doctrines or terms in a remedial statute has to take on a different meaning when it's put into the statute by the General Assembly, including the remedial purpose. And this court held in Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company versus St. John that the higher burden of proof would be inconsistent with the remedial purpose of Code Section 8.01.66.1, which in that case the court was comparing statutory bad faith claim with the common law bad faith claim. At common law, the bad faith claim required clear and convincing evidence, which is not altogether unsurprising or surprising in that case, because to act in bad faith is to act fraudulently, according to this court's decision of Virginia Carolina Chemical Co. Corporation versus Carpenter in 1901. Nonetheless, this court held in that case that because of the remedial purpose, the higher burden of proof would be inconsistent. This court went on to say, absent legislative directive otherwise, an insured's evidentiary burden under this remedial statute is the preponderance of the evidence. There is nothing in the VCPA indicating that a higher burden of proof would be necessary for this particular cause of action. In fact, I believe the higher burden of proof would be inconsistent with the specifically stated remedial purpose that the General Assembly chose. As remedial legislation, this court has held that the VCPA must be liberally construed to avoid the mischief at which it is directed and to advance the remedy for which it was promulgated. And more specifically, most recently in Owens versus DRS Auto Phantom Works, Inc., this court held that the legislative purpose underlying the VCPA was twofold. One, to expand the remedies afforded to consumers, and two, to relax the restrictions imposed upon consumers at common law. The restriction, I suggest the General Assembly intended to relax, or one of the restrictions the General Assembly intended to relax, was the burden of proof. The U.S. Supreme Court in Herman and McLean versus Huddleston, cited on brief, was dealing with the question, same question, preponderance or clear and convincing evidence standard in the securities fraud case. And there, the Supreme Court went on to describe what the preponderance standard means. And the court said, the preponderance standard allows parties to share the risk of error in roughly equal fashion. Any other standard expresses a preference for one side's interest. And that's exactly what the clear and convincing evidence standard does. If this court, as the trial court did, holds that the clear and convincing evidence standard applies, the court would be expressing a preference for suppliers over consumers, and I do not believe the General Assembly intended to do that.
So the common law does that? The common law has a preference for the fraud feasors?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I think the logic in Herman and McLean versus Huddleston and Harrods versus 60 Internet Domain Names clarifies why the common law does that. It was easy to feign fraud at common law, and as a result, the burden of proof, clear and convincing evidence, was applicable. The U.S. Supreme Court in Herman and McLean versus Huddleston went through that analysis and said reference to the common law is unavailing here. And the entire point is common law versus modern statutes. In modern statutes, we've got much greater protections against abuse. And the VCPA is a modern statute with modern safeguards against abuse. This is not the same as a common law fraud action. In fact, in this case, the Virginia General Assembly has clearly defined the elements of a VCPA violation. It has clearly defined the terms of those elements in Code Section 198. The General Assembly clearly prescribes very specific conduct in Code Section 200, and then goes on in 207 to provide an affirmative defense for unintentional violations. And that fact was influential in this court's decision in RFMP Court versus Little, where this court said the willful and knowingly provision of that particular act essentially serves as a safeguard against innocent persons being charged with violating that statute. The same thing is true here. For an unintentional violation, the ramifications are certainly not the same for suppliers versus intentional violations. So those modern safeguards fit snugly within the analysis of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Herman and McLean versus Huddleston, the Fourth Circuit's decision in Herod versus 60 Internet Domain Names, and Blue Chip Stamps versus Manor Drug Stores. All of those decisions deal with that same issue, and I think support my argument in this case.
Constructive fraud doesn't require scienter.
I'm sorry?
Constructive fraud does not require scienter, much like these provisions as interpreted by this court doesn't require scienter. And yet constructive fraud is coupled with a clear and convincing standard.
Yes, sir. And I would suggest to the court that if the burden of proof was not different, then there would be no use for the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. Essentially, then what the General Assembly did...
You wouldn't get treble damages, you wouldn't get attorney's fees, you wouldn't get all sorts of remedial provisions that the common law didn't offer.
That would be correct. But this court has to interpret the Virginia Consumer Protection Act as a whole. And I would suggest that the court has to apply the same burden of proof to all 54 different violations of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act, some of which bear some resemblance to the common law fraud, most of which do not. Most of those 54 violations don't have anything to do with common law fraud. Some of them are mere breaches of contract. Some of them are mere including certain language in a contract or excluding other language in a contract. Those violations of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act certainly would not include a higher burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence. But we have a handful of violations that use the word misrepresenting. The General Assembly chose to use the word misrepresenting, but the General Assembly also chose to use the word fraudulent acts or practices. The beginning of Code Section 859.1200A says the following fraudulent acts or practices are hereby declared unlawful. All 54 violations are listed equally underneath subsection A. Therefore, all of those violations are deemed fraudulent acts or practices by the General Assembly, but they're not fraudulent at common law. So clearly we're talking about two very different things. And this, or the U.S. Supreme Court's analysis in Grogan versus Garner, I think, is instructive as to how this court should interpret the structure of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. There was no indication that the General Assembly intended for a higher burden of proof to apply to the discharge exception in bankruptcy, even for a fraud provision over an alimony or child support exception. The Supreme Court said by listing them one after the other in equal fashion with no indication that one would get a higher or special burden of proof over the other, the legislature in that instance essentially said that they should all be treated the same. And absent any legislative directive otherwise, preponderance standard applies. The same is true here. There is no legislative indication that a higher burden of proof would apply to, for example, subsection A17, which is when a supplier and a consumer have a disagreement in a consumer transaction, they enter into an agreement to resolve that disagreement. If you don't abide by that agreement, you've violated the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. That is a mere breach of contract. It has nothing to do with common law fraud. It would be a preponderance standard. In fact, counsel for Mr. Fauber and Fauber Enterprises conceded that fact at trial, and I believe he conceded it on brief that some of the violations would lend themselves more to a preponderance standard than to a clear and convincing evidence standard. My position is that the court should apply the same standard to all violations of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. And I'll buttress that point by the phraseology used in the very first sentence of 59.1204A, which says, any person who suffers a loss as a result of a violation of this chapter. In other words, all violations are created equally. There is no one greater violation over the other. The General Assembly essentially was intending to put suppliers and consumers on an even playing field, and the higher burden of proof does not do that. I've asked the court to reverse the trial court and remand for retrial on the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. If there aren't any other questions, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court, I'm Greg Cochran from Lynchburg, Virginia. Caskey and Frost, Eric Harrison, my co-counsel, sits at the table with me. We represent the Appalese, Faubor Enterprises, Inc., and Bernard Faubor. I'd like to take up something Mr. Ostfine said first before I actually begin with regard to the various statutes that are referenced in the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. There are some 34 other statutes incorporated by reference in the Act. Some would arguably require proof by preponderance of the evidence. Some carry criminal penalties with them, ranging from Class 4 misdemeanors to Class 5 felonies. I don't think you can look at the Consumer Protection Act and whatever burden of proof you ultimately determine is applicable under the Consumer Protection Act and find violations of criminal statutes by either preponderance of the evidence or clear and convincing evidence. I think you have to look at a criminal violation by evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
The law of fraud and misrepresentation at common law is exceptionally well developed. Would we agree upon that?
Yes.
In a lot of cases.
It's certainly.
You've just indicated there's 34 separate statutes that were already in existence when VCPA was enacted that dealt with, to some extent, perhaps to a great extent, the same subject matter as VCPA. Do we agree upon that?
They certainly are referenced in the VCPA in a violation of any one of those.
Some relevance to VCPA. If we already have an exceptionally well-developed area of the common law, and if we already have 34 separate statutes, what was the General Assembly intending to do by enacting the VCPA in the first place?
My view, or on behalf of the appellees, is that the General Assembly was attempting to bridge violations of what would be common law fraud with claims that would arise under the UCC, where you don't have these enhanced remedies available. Typically, consumer transaction type claims that would arise either under common law contract or under the UCC, and the General Assembly thought it prudent to bridge the gap between cases with similar facts that might not meet the fraudulent standard, but yet would not fully compensate an aggrieved plaintiff under the common law contract or UCC.
Can I interpret that your belief is that the VCPA is primarily merely filling in gaps?
I view it as a bridge between the common law fraud and the contract law.
Now, second line of questions. Would you agree that it is rare for the General Assembly to include a statement of intent or a statement of policy when it enacts a statute?
Rare.
Let me rephrase that. Presuming it's rare for the General Assembly to enact a statement of intent or a statement of policy,
yes.
What weight should this court give to the statement in 59.1197? It is the intent of the General Assembly that this chapter shall be applied as remedial legislation to promote fair and ethical standards of dealings between suppliers and the consuming public.
It is our position that the Act is important consumer remedial legislation, and that this court in its...
And therefore should be construed liberally under our jurisprudence.
It is to be construed liberally. This court in its case decisions, Wilkins versus Peninsula Auto Cars, and also in the more recent case of Owens versus Auto Works, has said that there are relaxed elements of proof for the claims that arise under the VCPA, and that's our position. That as said in Owens and also earlier in Wilkins, that the VCPA goes beyond the confines of common law fraud.
So we've established first that to some extent, and we may have a disagreement, but to some extent, VCPA substantively goes beyond the common law and goes beyond the existing plethora of statutes.
Yes.
Second of all, we've established that the General Assembly, I believe rarely, but the General Assembly has actually told us how to interpret it, which is as remedial legislation because of a particular societal problem that the General Assembly has identified. Final question. This court gives special deference to administrative agencies with regard to that agency's area of expertise. Do you
acknowledge? Yes, sir, that's right.
We don't give special deference to the agency's interpretation of law specifically. Nonetheless, the agencies will often give us what they believe their interpretation of law should be. You're aware that the Office of the Attorney General is, in fact, an implementing agency for VCPA cases. Would you wish to respond to their amicus brief in any fashion?
The Attorney General has given a special section under the VCPA to make its own claims, and I think it has the same interest as the plaintiff does in this case. Our focus has been on how the statute was written and how it deviates from the law from which, the uniform law from which it was taken. And we believe that it deviates in significant, important, compelling language. And in the language that it uses, it especially in the subsections that are at issue in this particular case, which are 200 subsection 6 and 200 subsection 14, the language that is employed by the General Assembly in those sections is so much more strong and demonstrative than the language in the Uniform Code with the corresponding subsections, that one must look to see why the General Assembly deviated in that regard, especially in subsection 14. It uses all of the words that are buzzwords, if you will, for fraud. the uniform law from which it was taken does not.
As you know, there are two types of uniform laws. One would be the Uniform Commercial Code, which is intending to establish to the greatest extent possible the exact same floor, the exact same law nationwide. Is this that sort of a law, or is this one where it is essentially a model statute that was given?
I don't think this is the same as the UCC, no, sir.
So it's a model statute.
I think this is a model statute created by the combination of the Council of the States and
Council of State Governments.
State governments, and that the various states implemented through their legislatures, their respective legislatures, their own statutes.
And in fact, there are a multitude of differences among the states, according to the Commonwealth of State Governments.
I believe that to be true. Yes.
So what can we take from that in terms of Virginia?
Well, I think Virginia acted in 1977 in its own behalf, presumably with arguments from the various interests that form the legislature, and came up with the language that we're looking at today. Taking an aside, one of the tenets that this court follows is that it interprets the language of a statute and tries to give effect to every word and tries to avoid uselessness, surplusage, redundancy. And we feel that in Section 207, which is the defense section, that establishes a burden of proof for an innocent violation or a violation that was not under the control of the supplier by a preponderance of the evidence, that would be surplusage or uselessness or redundancy, whatever you might want to call it, if the burden of proof throughout the remainder of the act was by a preponderance of the evidence.
But isn't the supplier in this instance a defendant?
Yes.
So when it's talking about the preponderance of the evidence, isn't it referring to what the defendant would be putting forward in its defense?
Correct.
Is that not apples and oranges with the issue that we have to deal with in this case?
Well, I think you would not have to have that language if the burden of proof throughout the act were preponderance of the evidence, or a claimant came to bring a claim, and the burden of proof was preponderance of the evidence. I think 207 would not have to have language that says if a supplier defendant proves by preponderance of the evidence.
Counsel, may I, before you run out of time, interrupt you with this question? I again wonder if we are making these cases too hard when they're simpler. As I understand your argument, you have a very simple premise, which is the common law says clear and convincing, this is an implied repeal, and implied repeals aren't allowed. But that presupposes the major premise, which is the common law is being codified here. But that's very problematic. The common law is truly not being codified because common law requires scienter, and the only exception is constructive fraud, and that's limited to a very narrow band of relationships, right? So if we have what appears to be what we have, a gigantic cataloging of various and sundry things statutorily deemed a fraudulent practice as opposed to some common law concept, and it includes remedies unknown in the common law, and it dispenses with perhaps the most important element of common law fraud, which is scienter. Why do we have a conflict at all with the common law? Why isn't the first premise, well, I don't need to worry about implied repeal of the common law because this is not codifying the common law. This is a new genre of statutory remedies called fraudulent practices, or whatever they want to call it, it doesn't matter. But it is surely not something we would ever find in Blackstone or Lord Coke.
I don't disagree with what you say.
Well, that's going to hurt you.
What I say is that in use of the words and verbiage that the General Assembly used in writing this law and in deviating from what it was the uniform language. It used language that implicitly tells us.
But now you're in a whole different situation. Instead of coming down off the mountain of common law, and there's a lot of evidence, a lot of case law that says you need a lot to come off that mountain with some statute, you want to come up from the default of preponderance, which is the default in every case, absent a common law precursor to the contrary, and move it to a higher standard through, you know, comparing and contrasting words here, words there. Now, that's even a harder sell, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean, you may say it's a harder sell, but I think that the deviation is so significant in this case with the words used and the relaxation for a claim to prove the elements being acknowledged in the case decisions, that the burden of proof, the plaintiff still needs to prove a misrepresentation, but not much more. And the burden of proof, in our view, because of the words used by the Assembly, General Assembly, focuses its intent that burden be by clear and convincing evidence.
All right, sir, your time has expired. Thank you.
I rely on the statement remaining in our brief and ask that the court affirm.
I'd like to address an important question raised in opposing counsel's argument. What is the purpose of the Virginia Consumer Protection Act? In the source cited and relied upon heavily by the defendants, Consumer Protection in the Law, Section 2:9, the source says common law actions for consumers were considered inadequate. The relatively heavy burden of proof and the numerous defenses encountered by the litigant in common law fraud and warranty cases led some legislatures to conclude that consumers needed a statutory cause of action for marketplace deception and unfairness that would not be so difficult to pursue in a state action. That's a source cited and relied upon by the defendant, and it says very clearly the purpose of the VCPA is not to bridge some gap between common law fraud and the UCC, but is to fill a gap created by modern society in the common law. Common law did not approach or provide a remedy for consumers in this context. The purpose of the VCPA, the General Assembly acknowledged that consumers were out there on unequal footing with suppliers and they were not receiving the benefits that they should under the law. That's the purpose of the VCPA. The VCPA is not limited to common law fraud or any other type of fraud or misrepresentations. It is much more broad than that, and it should be interpreted as broader than that. And the burden of proof should be applicable for all 54 violations and not just for 1, 2, 6, or 14. It should be the same for all of them. I'd also I'd like to address what I believe the appellee's argument is, that the word fraudulent plus the word misrepresentation in the VCPA somehow equals clear and convincing evidence in this particular case. The argument, I think, is belied by the General Assembly's violation listed in subsection A9, making false or misleading statements of fact concerning the reasons for existence of or amounts of a price reduction. A9 clearly references a misrepresentation, but doesn't use the word misrepresentation. If the appellee is going to hang its hat solely on the use of the word misrepresentation in conjunction with the word fraudulent, I think that argument is belied by that subparagraph.
Counsel, does this statute preempt a common law fraud action?
No, sir. Common law fraud actions still exist.
So the consumer could file two counts. Common law fraud, and I want my common law because that's what I want. And I also want the statutory cause of action, and whatever the damages are duplicative they are, we'll decide later, right?
Yes, sir.
But isn't that a big deal? Because it's not changing the common law, modifying the common law, or repealing the common law. It's just adding a wholly different new statutory cause of action
Absolutely, and that's reinforced by this court's opinion in Owen, which says the remedial purpose would be nullified by an interpretation of the VCPA that said it's merely declarative of the common law. This is not a declaration of the common law. It's its own thing. It's a new statutory cause of action. It creates a new substantive right for consumers in Virginia. It's not linked to or conditioned on the common law. The common law ideas of clear and convincing evidence are not imported by the use of language that may be familiar to the common law. And there's no difference in this case using words that are familiar to the common law in the St. John case, Nationwide Mutual Insurance versus St. John. Bad faith is a common law idea. The General Assembly put it in a statute, and this court said, absent legislative directive otherwise, the burden of proof is preponderance. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.